The Director of Naval Intelligence, Vice Admiral Ted Branch, is now in his ninth month on the job with no access to classified information. The Navy announced last November Branch was one of the officials they were investigating in the fraud and bribery scandal involving ship husbanding. That is one of the stories Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu is writing about in this week's edition of Inside the Reporter's Notebook, the tentacles of the Fat Leonard scandal having implications all over the Navy, Jared.
Yeah, that's right. And even though I think this is an important story, it's also not exactly breaking news in the sense that the Navy, as you said, did publicly announce that Admiral Branch was going to be barred from access to classified information back in November. It did make news at the time, but since we media types have short attention spans, that aspect and a lot of other things in the husbanding scandal kind of faded from the headlines. Then I heard recently from a Navy source that, hey, by the way, that's still not resolved. The Admiral's had his clearance is suspended this entire time, 9 months, which kind of surprised me. So, and obviously when you're the Director of Naval Intelligence, and by the way, also the Navy CIO and the Chief of Information Dominance, that's pretty significant. But the Navy's top spokeswoman confirmed that for me today. It is actually true. They basically said they also don't know how much longer this is going to be the case. They're waiting for the Justice Department and the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, NCIS, to get to a point in their investigation where they can tell the Navy some level of detail about the allegations against Admiral Branch so that they can either get comfortably restore his access or take other action, you know, whatever that might be.
This has become tremendously far more layered, I think, than anybody would have suspected when we first learned about this scandal surrounding Carrier Strike Group 1 and the company's name, Glenn Defense Marine Asia. Leonard Francis, the owner of that company, thanks a lot, by the way, to him for sullying the name.
Yeah.
The issues at play here are going, I think, far deeper than anybody expected because this I believe people assumed this is something that happened far away from Washington. This is not something that happened, it seems, at least at the time, at a very high level. And yet the implications now are turning out to be far broader and deeper than anybody anticipated.
That's right. And I should have said at the outset, and I want to say now, that there is no allegation, at least publicly, from prosecutors, from any kind of official, that Admiral Branch did anything illegal, improper, that he committed any kind of violation. He is involved in this investigation in some way or another. He is a target in some way or another. I do think that the fact that he is still in that position tells you something about the Navy's level of confidence that if he did something improper, it was pretty minor. The Navy has a pretty strong reputation for holding senior officials accountable and doing so publicly when it thinks that they've done something wrong. I think probably one of the things, this is just my speculation in part, but I think one of the things at play here is one of the reasons that Admiral Branch has been in that position so long without a security clearance is that the person who would need to relieve him, Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Jonathan Greener, just really truly doesn't want to end the career of someone who really may have done nothing wrong. And I think there's probably quite a bit of frustration inside the Navy about how little they know about what the Justice Department thinks went on in this case. They obviously have some level of evidence or suspicion, at least, because he is involved in this investigation. Another thing, you mentioned Carrier Strike Group 1. That strike group, I don't think we know for a fact, had any kind of, you know, untoward relationship.
Correct. Thank you for pointing that out. That's an error on my part.
With Glenn Defense Marine, the only reason I brought it up in the notebook is because what we do know from the Navy is that the reason his clearances were suspended was because of some activity that he was involved in regard to this case and prior to becoming the N2N6, the Director of Naval Intelligence. The reason I mentioned that Carrier Strike Group is because the timeline coincides with the time when all of this is going on based on what prosecutors have made public in court filings, and that's really the only assignment in that time frame where he was serving in the Pacific Theater.
Thank you for that correction, and you are correct and my mistake there, and I appreciate you calling my attention to it.
Sure.
Another item you are looking at inside the reporter's notebook this week is the overuse of firm fixed price level of effort contracts at the Department of Defense. That sounds a little esoteric on the surface, but it's a lot bigger issue than one might think as I read what you're writing.
It is kind of a big deal, and this came from comments that Dick Ginman, the director for Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, made to reporters last week at an FCA acquisition modernization conference. This basically, it sounded like it came as somewhat of a surprise to him, but after he had done some digging through contract data, he found out that this particular type of contract had been used much more frequently than he would have suspected. And the reason that's a problem is because, well, let me back up a second. There's another type of contract, just to make things even more esoteric for you. Sorry about that.
No worries.
fixed price level of effort, he believes, has been used as an alternative to another type of contract called time and materials that DOD has really cracked down hard on lately. It does not want people to use time and materials contracts unless they're absolutely necessary, because it's basically just reimbursing the contractor for all of their costs and giving them no incentive to try and control costs to the government. So what he thinks is happening is that people are using these fixed price level of effort contracts as sort of a workaround to that. They're actually very similar in a lot of ways, but the Federal Acquisition Regulation makes clear that you're not supposed to use them if you're buying something for more than $150,000. When he went back and looked at the data, he found that the department spent $1.4 billion on this contract type in fiscal 2013, and a lot of these contracts ran into the multiple millions of dollars, which according to the FAR is very explicit about this. You're not supposed to go above that $150,000 threshold, and it's also supposed to be specifically for research and development where you're paying a firm to do this kind of research, where you can't forecast at the outset exactly what kind of work is going to be done. You just know that there's a given level of effort that's going to take. So I think he feels that there's definitely some abuse in this area, given the number of uses of this particular type of vehicle and the dollar threshold that they reached last year.
Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu inside the reporter's notebook, and you can read it at federalnewsradio.com. One more item. Bad news for the former director of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
Yeah, it could have been much worse news. The DOD Inspector General, and by the way, this report that they issued was first published is the wrong word, but first completed back in March of 2013. It's been sitting on shelves inside the Defense Department because they designated it as for official use only. It finally became public this week in response to Freedom of Information Act requests. But essentially what they found is they substantiated just one of several allegations that had been made against Dr. Dugan, the former DARPA director, and they essentially found that she had promoted products and services that had been made and that she had helped create at a company that she founded called Red X Defense a few years earlier. And specifically, what she did, according to the report, was when she was briefing senior officials from the Joint Forces Command and from the Joint Improvised Explosives Defeat Organization, she used slides from that company, logos from that company, specific taglines and phrases from that company's marketing materials as a way to describe what she thought should be done in order to defeat IEDs. She, to her credit, recused herself from any decisions that would have involved giving contracts to that specific company while she was at DARPA. But according to the report, she still, was basically pitching a line to senior officials in DOD that directly furthered that company's business interests. And there weren't too many other companies besides that one that could have fulfilled, the needs that she was, expressing in those briefings.
Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu. I want to go back to the first piece with Admiral Branch.
Sure.
One item we didn't get to cover on that. Do we have any sense at all of any kind of a timeline on the dispensation of this, or is it really up to the investigative unit, to the Justice Department, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, that you cite in your column on federalnewsradio.com to complete their investigation in whatever timeline they have?
It's a kind of a complicated answer to that. The decision to remove his access to sensitive to classified information was a Navy decision, but they did it based on the nature of the allegations, the little bit of information that they did get from DOJ. They've heard really nothing back from DOJ since then to ameliorate those concerns. It's been kind of radio silence from the DOJ end to hear the Navy tell it. So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, according to the Navy. They really can't can't change this decision until they hear that this has come to a conclusion on the investigative end. One other piece of this that I should mention is that it's not as though the intelligence organization in the Navy is completely rudderless. Lynn Wright, who is the Admiral's deputy, is basically acting and performing a lot of the functions that he would need to do that would require access to classified information. And she's an extremely qualified career senior executive service member who spent an entire career dating back to the 80s working in the Navy intelligence arena. So, I mean, there are folks minding the store, but it still raises the question. There's got to be a point, it seems, at which, you know, some amount of time is too long for the Director of Naval Intelligence to be functioning without a security clearance. I don't know what that point is, but one surmises that that point has to exist.
Well, and yet the point that you made earlier about his removal being essentially ending his career is a valid one, too. And you want to make really, really sure, I imagine, if you're
Absolutely.
Admiral Greenert, that you don't make that decision lightly. And boy, if you make it the wrong way, what a big mistake that turns out to be.
That's right. And again, I hate to keep repeating myself, but it is kind of a rock and a hard place decision for the Navy. And I don't think when they first suspended this clearance that they probably imagined that they would be waiting for 9 months plus to get final resolution on what the accusations are and what the investigation entails and whether or not they can be comfortable restoring the clearance.
Federal News Radio's DOD reporter Jared Serbu going inside the reporter's notebook. Excellent as always, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you as always.